Yeah. Yeah. What? Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hello there. Hi. Welcome to another episode of the Lavender Fix podcast. I'm your host, Sabreen Hazik, and last week I made a new friend. As you know, Instagram is a new way to connect, and I have been following our guest for today for about 3 years, probably more. And this wonderful person has been on my outreach list, or rather my hit list, for quite some time, and so I finally did it. I asked him to be on the show. Yes. My next guest is Aamir Vani, the photographer, filmmaker, poet, and a writer from Kashmir. Aamir's work is hugely inspired by Kashmiri American poet Aga Shahid Ali. And I have so much to say about his accomplishments. I mean, he is a multi-award-winning photographer and has been honored with India's Best Travel Photographer by Travel and Leisure, the M Billionth Award by DEF, and the UN World Awards for Heritage and Tourism, alongside many, many, many more. After graduating from university in the UK, he returned to Kashmir in 2014 and started his photography career soon after. Aamir has dedicated his art to showcasing Kashmir as a story of hope, love, beauty, and innocence. His stunning Instagram account, Kashmir Through My Lens, undoubtedly earns him an easy follow, with close to 99,000 followers. Aamir's work makes you fall in love with the history and culture of Kashmir. He is currently pursuing his MFA in filmmaking in Paris and is recording live with us from Paris today. Hi, Aamir. Welcome to the Lavender Fix. How are we doing today?
Hi, Sabreen. I'm good. How are you? And first of all, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure. Honestly, I've been following your podcast for a while now, and it's a pleasure to be here with you.
I mean, you are so out of my league, but I'm just so honored to have you here. So I think it's my pleasure to have you on here. So thank you for taking the time to do this. And yeah, so all right. I mean, I am just going to start off with a very basic question, probably too basic, which I'm sure you've been asked a million times. But where does your passion for photography stem from? Have you always been interested?
Photography for me was a hobby, but I would never thought that I'd take it professionally. But once I came back to Kashmir, I started taking photos, and then sort of the whole passion came from Kashmir itself and the people of Kashmir, and I wanted to sort of share the story of Kashmir through how I see it through my lens. And yeah, That's how it basically started.
That's how Kashmir Through My Lens was born. So, Aamir, I know for a fact that, you know, you studied in the UK and then you also sort of were working there. And that's huge. You know, I mean, it's really hard to survive in UK or US market, just even getting hired after you finish your graduation. So what was life like in the UK, and why the heck did you decide to move back to Kashmir?
I did my schooling in Kashmir, and then I went to the UK for my university. And after my post-graduation, I luckily found a job, and it was not easy, but thankfully I was lucky enough to find a job and I started working. But you know, life there is obviously, I came from Kashmir and it was totally different for me. Like, I got so much exposure, I saw so many things that I was like, okay, so this is what is happening in the world. Because in Kashmir, you're very limited. You're like sort of living in a bubble. And then when I was there, I saw a different side to life. But then Kashmir was always there, you know. And as a Kashmiri, I feel like, you know, it happens with all of us.
Oh, yes.
Kashmir is always there in the back of your mind. No matter where you go, Kashmir never leaves you.
Yeah.
So I always wanted to come back. But I wanted to come back, and basically I wanted to have a purpose of me coming back. I didn't just want to come back. So I was perhaps waiting for the right time. And then, you know, I left my job and I decided to move back. It got to a point where I was like, you know, this is the time that I must go back. The thing is that with Kashmir, like all the people who I met in London while I was there, Kashmir was, people, when they would ask me where I come from, and I would tell them I'm from Kashmir. Some of them knew about Kashmir, you know, it's a beautiful place. And some of them knew about, well, actually most of them only knew about Kashmir because of the conflict.
Yeah.
So for me, I think it reached to a point where I was like, you know, it is, obviously there is a conflict going on, but there are other things to Kashmir, you know.
Yeah, than that.
Yeah, exactly. And people need to see that. And that for me was like sort of the,
the moment.
And I was like, okay, I need to go back and do something.
Yeah. And so what I'm curious about is, I mean, first of all, I think that that was really brave of you to do that because, you know, I mean, I moved out. I was in India. So I moved out in 2015 and then I never really looked back. But it's different. I understand that for someone who was raised in, you know, Kashmir, it's probably different. It's different for my partner because that's where he's from and I totally see it. Right. So one thing is that, you know, as Southeast Asians, you know, having your kids working in a different country is somehow like a matter of pride, you know, especially like a place like London, right? So was your decision to move back to the Valley received well by your parents, or was there a lot of speculation about what you really wanted to do in life and in your career, and if you had a goal at all?
Not at all. I mean, it wasn't received well by my parents. Like you said, you know, it's a matter of pride for them also. They were like, oh, yeah, Amara Beta, you know, our son is there and he's working there, all of that. But when I decided, so I didn't tell them that I'm coming back. I just showed up, basically. Yeah.
You are brave.
And initially they thought, okay, fine, he's here for a week or two and he'll go back. But then when I did not go back, then I told them that, okay, I've decided I'm not going back and I want to do something here. And they kept pushing, especially my father, he kept pushing me like, he's like, you know, there's nothing here, there's no opportunities, and you, why are you doing this, and you should go back. But, and the other thing was like, he was like, okay, fine, if you want to work here, what do you want to do? And I had no answer for that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know. I knew that I want to do something for Kashmir, but what, I didn't know. So it was really difficult, you know, telling him and making him understand. And even now, we have conversations at times where he's like, okay, I know you're doing this, but what is it exactly that you're doing? Because he doesn't understand completely.
Sure.
So it was very difficult. But I think what I would like to say is, what basically my parents, for example, I felt that it's not their, obviously they are concerned, but it was more of like what the society thinks and what the extended family is going to talk, you know, what are they going to say about it and all of that. So it was more coming from that. So it wasn't easy, but you know, I was determined. I was like, I need to do this. So
Awesome. I mean, more power to you that you felt so strongly about it. But so in that very moment when you actually told them, when you verbalized it, right? So if you were to think of that exact moment when you told them, I am not going back, what was that first reaction like? I mean, I'm trying to understand if you faced the music or, you know, how did it just go? Because I'm pretty sure, you know, as parents, they must have asked you a bazillion questions about what is the plan, finances, how are we doing this? So what was the plan when you got there and you were like, okay, I'm going to break it to them? And so how did they respond?
It wasn't easy. My father was, so when I told them that this is my decision, I'm not going to go back. And in it, the first reaction was, no, you're going back. They were not ready to listen to anything. My father was like, no, you have to go back. You can't do anything here. There's nothing, you know, here, there's no opportunity. So you need to go back. But I was like, no, I want to do something here. So then came the question, what do you want to do?
Yeah.
And again, like I said, I didn't have an answer to that. So so for him, it was really difficult to understand where I was coming from.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even when I was working or studying, I feel like all those years I was trying to figure out what I want to do. I didn't I hadn't figured it out. And the moment I figured it out, I came back.
Yeah.
But it was really difficult for me to make my father understand that, you know, that, that I came back and this is my passion, that I want to do something. But again, I didn't have any plans.
Yeah,
like, there was no...
And quite frankly, like Southeast Asian parents don't really understand this. Like they expect their kids to have everything planned out. And, you know,
yeah.
There's this whole question around what is the goal in life? So, you know, when you actually got there, what was the plan? Like, what was the survival plan?
So I thankfully, although I did come, you know, all of a sudden, but I had some savings. When I came back, and I survived on those savings because I was at a point where I couldn't ask my father to support me.
Yeah.
Although he wouldn't have said no, I'm sure. But, you know, it's just, you know, you don't want to do it because
you're
an adult, you're grown up. So so I had some savings which helped me because the first year I came to Kashmir, I returned. I had zero work. I had no income whatsoever. And I was trying to... I was trying to understand what can I do and how can I sustain myself in a place like Kashmir. And then when I started photographing and I realized that slowly people started liking it, you know, photography. And I was like, okay, maybe I can do something with this. Mm. So I kept on pushing on it. But like first year, there was no income, nothing at all. So through that year, it was my savings that really helped me survive. I think if I didn't have those savings, I would not have been able to survive.
Yeah.
So
gotcha.
It's important to sort of have, you know, because a lot of the times you just do it. You're like, okay, I'm quitting and I don't know what to do. But I think there has to be
some sort of
plan B. Like if it doesn't work out.
Okay, so that's good to know. That's good to know that you were thinking things through. It wasn't just one of those things where you're like, I'm going to become smoke and then finally appear in Kashmir. That's really good to know.
Yeah.
So, you know, you said something really interesting a few minutes ago. You said that, you know, the world we come from is kind of obsessed with society and what others think about you. And quite frankly, they're concerned with like how much money they have, whose child is doing what in life. So how did people from your, because, you know, your parents, clearly they were very concerned about what are we going to tell people, you know, at the back of their mind, I'm pretty sure. So how did people from your extended family respond to you shifting from the land of, so to say, milk and honey and, you know, the land of opportunities? So how was that?
So it wasn't... Like you said, you know, at the end of the day, it all comes down to how much money are you making.
Exactly.
And if you're making any. So my extended, well, the thing is with what I have done is, and it's from the beginning also, I have sort of kept a border, you know, between me and my extended family. Not my close family, but my extended family. That they're what they say or what they... you know, to talk about it, I don't let it affect me.
Gotcha.
I know that it does affect my parents, but I don't let it affect me because, you know, honestly, like I said, at the end of the day, it all comes down to if you're making money. And when I started making money and when my parents saw it, that, okay, he's doing something. And when I started getting recognition, that's when my father also realized, because initially he would bring in, you know, when I returned, he would bring in all these forms from JNK Bank of Mumbai, you should fill it in, you know, all of those things. But I would say no. And then when I started making money, he also sort of was like, okay, maybe he's doing something, he's going somewhere. So then he also was like, in a way, he understood. And then the recognition, and sometimes you would see there's TV interview of me and stuff.
Yeah.
So that would sort of help him to even like tackle his friends or family who are saying things about him, you know.
Yeah, it gives them something to work with.
Yeah.
Right. So going back to year one, let's talk a little bit more about, you know, how did you go about establishing yourself as a photographer, especially when you had to really earn your parents' trust, right? How did you navigate the challenges and really prove to them that you had made the right decision? So what were you doing during this time?
So when I returned, I had, like I said, I had no plan whatsoever, and I did not know what I wanted to do, except that at least, you know, I used to tell everybody, even my friends who would ask me, so what are you going to do? So I always would tell them that I don't know what I'm going to do, but I know one thing that I will not do again, and that's the job that I was doing.
Yeah.
So I was trying to figure it out, that what I want to do and how can I. But, you know, the whole of me returning to Kashmir, it all was because of Kashmir.
Yeah.
And that love for Kashmir. So I knew that I want to do something that would somehow, you know, involve Kashmir and help me change
maybe the perception.
About Kashmir, or tell stories. And then I picked up a camera. I just started on my phone. I used to take pictures, and then I started sharing them on Instagram, and it was okay. People were like reacting to it, and then I started writing like small couplets or captions with the photos and post them, and people received it well. And then it struck me. I was like, okay, maybe I can do something with this.
Yeah.
And so I, without thinking that I'm gonna, to be honest, I didn't at the beginning, I didn't even think that I'm gonna make money out of it.
Yeah. You know?
And I started pushing it, and I really got, you know, I started learning on YouTube and things like that. I would read all these things about photography and stuff. So that's how I started.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It took me, like I said earlier, it took me a year to get my first.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, so, and we will get to that because that's very interesting. I'm actually really excited to ask you about that first assignment. So, Amir, you know, anyone pursuing a career in visual arts has to have a portfolio, right? It allows you to show and not just tell. So, you know, as the portfolio being the greatest selling point for a photographer to get paid assignments, how did you go about building your portfolio in a place like Kashmir?
So it happened over the period of, I think, 2 or 3 years that I built my portfolio, which I could show to the, you know, my potential clients. And what happens is when it comes to photography, generally what we see these days is it's all on social media, right? It's Instagram and Facebook, and everything is just there. But as a photographer, you need to have a portfolio, because, you know, not everybody is going to look on your Instagram and, you know, select you. Even if you want to apply for a job, you need to have a portfolio. And in a place like Kashmir, you know, it's not always, like I said, the first year I wasn't working for anyone. Nobody was paying me. But I was sort of, even in that year, I was trying to build something, like build my portfolio. So you need to, you know, really work on it and not sort of leave it and say, okay, my Instagram has 1,000 likes, so this is enough.
Yeah.
So you need to have a portfolio. It's important. And you know, coming to social media, if you're on Instagram and, you know, if you're getting your work through Instagram, or if you want to work through social media, you still need to have some sort of portfolio, maybe not the traditional portfolio that photographers have, but like a media kit, which basically has all your numbers, you know, you showcase your photos there and your best photos, and then you have your social media numbers there, your reach and your, you know, average likes and whatever, you know, all those things. You need to have that.
Exactly. Because sometimes I feel like there are two types of incomes that people earn through social media now. One is, you know, people look at your work, they're like, wow, I would love to get a high resolution print of this image. Right. And the other kind is that this guy has a lot of followers. I sell toothbrushes. Can you help me sell my toothbrush? Right? And so then the person has to come up with creative ways to kind of sell the bloody toothbrush as a photographer. So you could click photos or whatever. So I understand that. And so what was in your portfolio? Like, what were you doing in Kashmir to build your portfolio then?
I was like, so what happens is in Kashmir, when I started, at least at that time, we had hundreds of, you know, photojournalists who used to cover conflict and political things, you know, all those journalistic basically things. But I realized that there was nobody who was sort of trying to show the everyday life of Kashmir.
Right.
That life also exists parallelly to the conflict. So I realized that, you know, this was something that is missing. So when I started it, I think that's what really clicked with people, because there was something different that was coming out of Kashmir.
Right.
Because people were used to seeing only like one sort of, you know, images coming out of Kashmir, but this was something different. And that really helped me build portfolio and also give me recognition. And people were like, wait, okay, there's this guy from Kashmir and he's doing something different. So that sort of helped me. So I think, you know,
gotcha.
I was not trying to be like everybody else, and I was trying to find my own path, and I think that really worked.
Yeah, you have to, I think in any field you have to have a niche. So you were trying to do that, and I'm assuming you were kind of going around and exploring Kashmir and taking photographs of everyday life, and that's how you made your portfolio. Okay, awesome. That makes a lot of sense. And Kashmir is, I mean, so picturesque. There's no way you can get a bad photograph there. And, you know, with someone with your skills, I mean, it's that added magic. So what are some of the tact, I mean, obviously you were building the portfolio and money doesn't come right away, but what are some of the tactics you adopted to get clients to generate revenue in a place like Kashmir?
So so first I would like to add to the previous point that, you know, when I was going around Kashmir, when I was photographing and building my portfolio, I wasn't only focusing on the landscape of Kashmir, which is amazing. But what I was trying to do was basically talking to people and telling their stories. So I think that's also very important. But again, it depends on what sort of photography do you want to do.
Right.
For me, it was more like storytelling. That's what I wanted to do. That's what I've always wanted to do. I've always wanted to tell stories. So it wasn't just, you know, the beauty of the place, but it was also the beauty of the people and resilience of the people.
Right.
And now coming back to your question. So it's not easy getting work, especially in a field like photography. And Kashmir has a, unfortunately, although it's changing now, but we don't basically value people like photographers or artists, you know.
Correct.
So it was really hard to get work in Kashmir, but I used to keep a tab on, you know, what's happening in the market around, especially like traveling. I love traveling, so I was always interested in traveling, and when I started posting on Instagram, when people started recognizing my work, that was my first actually. Assignment or my first client came through Instagram, because they saw my work on Instagram and they were sort of, they liked it, and they were like, hey, we would really like to get some prints of your photos and everything. And then they had seen my work on Instagram, but I did send them what other things I'd been doing. Other than, because not everything goes on Instagram.
Yeah, of course.
So I did send them, you know, other things that I've been shooting. The first photo, although I didn't sell it for much, it was a very, you know, renowned
brand.
Brand. company. And when they approached me, I was really happy that they even approached me. You know, I didn't even think of how much they're going to pay me.
Yeah.
And although they didn't pay me much, but I was like, you know, on cloud nine, I was like, okay. Because that was my first paid job.
Right.
And that was the day I realized that this could also make me money. And, you know, I could survive if I do it properly and if I do it harder. So that's how it happened, really.
So when you got your first salary, did you like run to your parents and like, hey, by the way, this happened. Point proven.
Well, it wasn't salary because I it was only like, I think they bought 3 photos of me.
Yeah.
And shall I tell you how much it was?
Yeah, I am ready.
Okay. So one print I sold for 300 rupees.
That just, you know what? I know we're not going to highlight the brand. I know we're not going to talk about them. But if this brand is listening, you guys,
I hope they are.
Seriously,
and they don't do this to other people.
Amir, when we're done with this episode, please share it strategically so that it reaches people. But I have noticed this, and it's not just with photographers. I think it's with, you know, a lot of people, like in wedding filming or photography or just other kinds of art, right? All these global giants or big companies, not just, you know, maybe they're not global giants, but these big companies really need to get their shit together when it comes to paying people and freelancers and artists, because one, there is a huge trend of a barter system that we will give you a bloody coaster and you click a photograph with your glass on it with your face peeking into the frame, and I'm like, yeah, but my electricity bill cannot be paid in coasters. Unless you can talk to the electricity commission, I don't know, like, we can then talk about getting maybe 12 coasters to pay my bills off. So yeah, I mean, honestly, that's just shocking. But I understand that you, being the person that you are, you weren't really as invested in the idea of how much. You were just like, okay, this is a start.
Honestly, I was so happy that you know, I could sell something.
Yeah, I mean, it's validation.
I didn't tell my parents that I got 300 rupees there. But I did tell them, you know, I've started selling my photos and everything, and they were okay. I mean, you know, even now my father doesn't completely get it. You know, he doesn't completely understand, although it's much better now. But I feel also at the same time that he has supported me silently, you know.
Yeah, I hear you. He wants to support you just enough, but not to the point where you're like, okay, this is me. Yeah, because I was like, if you told him how much you made, he would have probably been like, how about I send you for another master's to the UK? That's incredible. I mean, that's huge, right? And let's just, you know, one more thing that I wanted to say is that sometimes, first of all, you should, I mean, obviously you didn't know as much back then, but you are now in a position where you can negotiate, and to everyone listening, you know, hopefully you'll take some kind of a lesson from this episode, right? Never be shy to speak up.
Because the thing is that there was nobody who I could ask, what should I do? I was like, okay, 300, that's amazing. But I didn't know, like, if I could negotiate and how much should I charge. I had no idea. Even though you were talking about the barter system, I'm guilty of doing it once.
I am sure. I mean, I did it.
I did it once. But then, you know, obviously, like, you know, it doesn't pay the bills. And I see a lot of people, young people especially, who've just started, they fall into this trap of barter, but it's not worth it. You know, you need to realize, you need to know your worth, and you need to ask for it. Otherwise, people will always take you, you know, for granted. And
Exactly. So, but, you know, the one thing that I did want to say is, and I hope it makes you feel better, is even though they didn't pay you your work's worth, right? The one good thing that probably came out of it was that you could say then that I have sold my photographs to this brand, and that's like huge, right?
Yes,
so
exactly.
You have to, and I'm pretty sure you strategically leveraged that. So
yeah, true. It did went on my, you know, CV that I worked with this brand.
Exactly. So let's talk about Instagram for a second, because I know that Instagram has been a huge selling point in your career, right?
Yeah.
Obviously, the medium has generated a lot of interest around your work. And of course, as I mentioned in our introduction, you know, your handle has an insane amount of following. I mean, I think you should definitely Google what 99,000 people look like, because I've done this with every time my podcast gets downloads. I'm like, how much does this number look like in people? And it just blows my mind. So 99,000 people is like insane. So how did your handle Kashmir Through My Lens come into being, and how did the exponential growth happen? What was the key to your success?
Interesting. Thank you, first of all. It actually happened over the time. Like, it's been now 6 years that I've been doing this, that Kashmir Through My Lens started. And like I said, initially there was no plan whatsoever. I just started taking photos. I was like, okay, Instagram, let me write my username Kashmir Through My Lens. There was no idea behind it.
Yeah.
It just happened. And it took me 6 years to reach where I am. And I think what has really helped me grow was, like I said earlier, that I was showing something different to people, which, you know, other photographers from Kashmir were not. Because when I started Instagram, there was hardly anybody around from Kashmir.
Right.
And people were obviously, they were starting, but I think, I was among the first ones when sort of, you know, was showing this side of, was doing this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
And that really helped me. And I think what also helped is the human connection, because I always tend to sort of, through my photographs or what I write, I want to convey something like from a human to human. I don't want to sort of, because of the politics of the place.
Yep.
I'm not sort of trying to, you know, give my political opinion about things, but I'm trying to tell you as a human, this is how I feel, and this is how this person feels, and this is his story, and I put it in front of people and ask them, so what do you feel about it? And they somehow connect to it.
Yeah.
And even there's that relatability. I think that's what has helped me to grow, because people relate to the stories. Yeah.
It almost sounds like you're talking about this podcast, because that's exactly why this podcast was launched. Are you talking about my podcast, Amit? Because this podcast is like my... Yeah, no, but it's amazing, right? And as you were saying that, it was huge validation for me, just because I feel like, okay, but this is exactly what I'm doing. And maybe that means that I'm on the right path, right? Because people crave human connection, and I agree. The only thing that has ever come out of Kashmir and, you know, all the artists is people... Of course, I understand that politics is such a huge, like, you can't talk about Kashmir and not politics, right? And I'm glad that people are using their platforms to voice their opinions, although I have been under a lot of fire in the past, so I always try and strike a balance. But you know you're so huge on Instagram, and I'm sure it comes with a lot of grime, right? Like, it doesn't come easy. And I have, I think, noticed a few comments on your channel where you are so decent in the way you respond. So did you get a lot of snide comments or remarks? Is there a lot of trolling, political jabs? What kind of criticism have you had to deal with?
Always, you know, it always happens, you know, Kashmiri, you know, whenever a Kashmiri speak, there always has to be somebody, you know, saying, no, this is wrong, you're saying wrong, things like that. But it always happens with me also. Like, but the thing is, like, it's even harder when it comes from your own people.
Correct.
And that has happened quite a lot. And it's not just me, you know, there are other Kashmiri artists and people I know who have the same story to sort of say,
sure.
Because The thing is, in Kashmir, when you talk about even a normal thing, it somehow becomes political.
Yeah.
People start taking sides, and that has happened a lot. I see in my comments sometimes people are fighting with each other, you know. And it is just, you know, all you have to do is, I mean, what I do is I have sort of over the time realized that there are people who would just not understand,
yeah.
No matter how much you make sense or how much try to make them understand, they don't want to understand. And I have tried sort of now, you know, I don't interact with them as much, but I try to talk through, you know, things that people have any questions or confusions, or even, you know, people who are being mean or nasty. I tend to be,
you disengage.
Yeah, and you know, if I have to engage, I will always be nice, because I feel,
yeah,
like if you, I've always believed in this, that, you know, if you want to talk about something, if you want to put your point across, there's no, people will not listen to you if you're aggressive.
Yeah, and if you stoop to their level, like, they're not going to listen.
And if you have something really, like, you know, important to say, and but you're aggressive about it, people will not listen to you. But at the same time, if you say the same thing with sort of a lot of love and calmness, people will understand and even relate to it, and they might even support you
right.
in what you're saying. And I think that's what sort of I've done over the time. And I realized, like I said, there are people who will never understand, so I've stopped talking to such people. And, you know, these comments, it shouldn't, the negative comments and this, all this negativity, I have not let it affect me anymore.
You.
It doesn't affect me anymore, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the interesting thing is the irrelevant comments that come in sometimes really make me laugh. I remember I clicked a photograph outside this cafe in Kashmir, and I was wearing trousers, and somebody commented saying, this is exactly why we get floods.
Yeah,
and I'm like, okay, so I am going to go back to my geography teacher and ask her, hey, so why did you not tell me that, like, Levi's is responsible for natural calamity?
There's a lot of things. Like I said, you know, it's even worse when it comes from your own people.
Exactly.
You know, like, I work with a lot of these companies, or, like, for example, a camera company, brand Sony.
Yeah.
And then obviously, you know, if I'm doing it on social media, I'm working with them on social media, so I have to tag them and everything. Then I would tag Sony India, right? People
Correct.
Would be like,
oh my God.
How are you working with Sony India? You're a traitor, and all. You know, it's like,
yeah.
It's so hard for me to, like,
yeah, yeah.
People understand. So I've stopped doing it now. You know, people can say whatever they want.
Yeah. I mean, work is work, and your politics has no, you know, unless you are, I don't know, saying something through your work, which doesn't
exactly.
go well with, which you're not, right?
Yeah,
and, you know,
and
I mean,
yeah.
Sorry. I shouldn't, yeah.
In fact, I've lost a lot of work because of this, because I don't want to, you know, because I have a conscience of my own, and I have,
Correct.
You know, there's some things, there are some rules, and there are things that I know I must not do no matter what. And I have lost so many, you know,
clients.
Contact. Yeah, because of these things. And even with, like, the things that I say, although I don't say it, you know, open, I don't say it loudly, but I do say things. I do talk about things. And that has also got me into trouble with my clients. And
oh my
a lot
God.
Of time, yeah. And a lot of the times the contracts being cancelled while I am in a contract, you know, I work for them, but then suddenly they're like, no, because you said this and you posted this, so we're not going to be working with any of you anymore.
Yeah, it is, you know, I hear you. I think as someone who works in marketing, it's just also really challenging from a PR standpoint. Sometimes when I post messages, you know, like during the US election, you never know what your clients believe in. Like,
yeah,
you know, do they believe, do they believe in this guy who looks like a Cheeto, or do they believe in an actual human being? So, you know, yeah. You have to be really careful. And, you know, to your point, Amir, I've spoken with so many folks from Kashmir, and the common USP across everything they say is that, and this is obviously no offense to people in Kashmir, realize that Amir is from Kashmir, I am part Kashmiri, so we are not speaking well for our own kind, is that the people in Kashmir make it very hard for other Kashmiris to live peacefully, even though they'll sacrifice their own life to save another Kashmiri. So how true do you think is that?
It's very true. I completely agree with you. Like I said, you know, it hurts even more when it's your own people.
Right.
Saying there's something called, there's no shying away from it. I'm not saying that, you know, every Kashmiri is like that, but it has happened quite a lot, and it's not just me, but with other people also, other artists from Kashmir also, you know, whoever is trying to do something, there will always be people who will, you know, pull the person down because, I don't know, they can't just see somebody successful.
Doing well, yeah. Amir, I interviewed this girl from Srinagar who has a food channel, right? She really scaled and did wonderful things with it. And you know, her episode will also be a part of the season. But she told me that she used to give voiceovers in English.
Uh-huh.
And then she started getting a lot of criticism that, why are your voiceovers not in Kashmiri? And she's like, because my audience is outside of Kashmir as well. Like, I need to make sure that people understand. So then people found another little thing, which is the way that she films her videos, she's not in them. It's like a countertop kind of a recording where, you know, the camera is placed in a way where you just see the cooking process. And people are like, why are you showing your hands that much? She's like, do you want me to cook with my feet? Like, what do you want me to do?
This is crazy. Like, I sometimes don't understand. You know, because my Instagram is Kashmir through my lens, but I've done a lot of travel assignments where I go with airlines or travel boards, tourism boards to different places. And when I post about it, then people are like, oh, why don't you change your name? Why is it still Kashmir through my lens? You're posting about pirates.
I
just don't understand that thing. What is going on with people? But this is true. I mean, you know, whenever somebody's doing well, there will always be people to bring him down. And with Kashmiri, unfortunately, it's even worse.
Yeah. My dear friends, if you're listening to this, yes, it is Kashmir through my lens, but sometimes it will be Alaska through my lens. Sometimes it will be Shimla through my lens. Sometimes it will be London through my lens. So please don't take it at face value. I mean, work is work.
Every post, but every other post I do, which is not Kashmir, somebody be like, oh, why have you named yourself Kashmir?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's like someone has a peanut allergy and they're like, what is the solution? And you're like, I'm just going to give you a little peanut every single day.
But yeah, like I said, you know, I've realized that there's no point in talking to such people, so I don't really engage.
Yes, that is a good strategy. I agree with that.
Yeah.
So, you know, Amir, keeping all the lurking negativity and the politics and the communication blockades and the general demotivation from the society in mind, how hard is it to scale as a photographer or a filmmaker in Kashmir? You know, what is the scope? What are some of the challenges an aspiring artist should be prepared for?
I mean, we didn't talk much about communication blockades, but that's okay. it's difficult as a photographer anywhere, and in Kashmir it gets even harder because of a lot of things. First, like, you know, I just said communication blockades. We don't know when our internet will go off, and you know, I've been in this position where I have to send photos to a client, but I don't have any internet, so you know, it's really difficult and it's so frustrating, and you don't know what to do. And some clients understand, but some don't, and you know, you don't get paid. You work for it for months, but then they're like, well, you didn't send it on time, so you know, forget that.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise also, because in Kashmir, like we see now, there's a lot of photographers, young photographers coming up. So there's a lot of competition. But what I feel in Kashmir is that we don't have an organized industry as such, you know,
right.
Whether it comes to filmmaking or photography. It's not organized, you know, it is all scattered. And mostly what people think now, in Kashmir especially, what I've seen is like, you know, you start an Instagram account or a Facebook page and you buy an expensive camera, start taking photos, and you become a photographer.
Correct.
Which is not the case when it comes to professional work. And trust me, it shows, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything about photography except like how to click a button. But then I learned over time, and I learned not just how to become better at being a photographer, you know, like technically, but also professionally.
Right.
And the things that you need to sort of have in order to work in a professional environment. I mean, posting on Instagram and, you know, all these things that anybody can do, but working in a professional, you know, environment is totally different.
Different.
And like I said, but there are so many young, you know, photographers who I see come up every day, and some of them are really amazing. And there is a lot of competition, but at the same time, there are opportunities as well.
Right.
I feel like, you know, we are often people say, well, you know, this is photography, especially in Kashmir, people are like, you know, what are you going to do? You will just open a studio, you know, like that traditional photo
studio. Oh my God, passport size photographs.
Exactly. You know, a lot of the times people still ask me, and, you know, back home, they ask me, okay, where is your studio, where is your photo shop, you know?
Oh my God. I mean, first of all, you know what? First of all, I have a comment there. I feel like even just when they say that, they in a way trivialize the hard work of people who actually have studios, right?
Yeah.
Because the way, like, in my mind, if someone says, do you have a studio? To me, it's a question, and the answer is no. But to them, it's one of those things where they are trying to suggest that you have a studio in a demeaning way,
yeah.
Right?
Yes.
It's disrespectful to, you know, there are people who have studios and who click passport size photographs and all that stuff, and that is work, and that gets them money, and that should be respected.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's just like, you know, you have to be a doctor, an engineer, or a civil servant. That's it. Otherwise, you know, or a government employee, whether, you know,
mm-hmm.
government employees are so in demand in Kashmir.
Yeah. Same job for 60 years.
Yeah.
And that's it.
But like, you know, photography is sort of, and filmmaking also, we don't have filmmakers, so to say, from Kashmir. I mean, we do have
a few.
A few who have recently started making films in Kashmir.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like a full-fledged industry. But I hope, you know, inshallah, you know, I have this dream of making sort of, I don't know, like making an industry of our own there, making films there. Because I feel it's important for us to tell our stories ourselves.
Right, absolutely. These are some challenges. And Amir, so speaking of challenges, I'm sure that your accomplishments did not come easy, right? I'm sure that as an artist, you must have had hard days with no clients or dry spells, you know, lack of work. Did it ever make you want to give up? You know, did it ever make you question your decision to keep pursuing this art form?
Not really. I mean, yeah, it wasn't easy, especially in the beginning. It's never going to be easy. Whenever you start something new, it's always going to be difficult. And like I said, if I had no savings, I would not have been able to survive. And then I might have, you know, did something else. But there was this passion, not only for the art, but because of Kashmir, you know, this passion, it's rooted in Kashmir.
Right.
I think that's one thing that never, you know, that did not let me give up.
Right.
At times I would have wanted to, but I know that, you know, it was Kashmir, it was the love for Kashmir that kept me pushing.
Mm-hmm.
And so once sort of I realized that I could make this work, and you know, then there was no looking back.
Now I know that poetry is another major interest of yours, and I often see that you marry the two art forms, that is photography and poetry. So talk to me a little bit about how words came into play, you know, when you were sharing your work. Like, how have you always been a bit of a poet, or where did it come from?
Poetry, you know, I think, it came from in my family. My grandfather, he writes.
Okay.
And I think maybe it came through him. And also, you know, I have these memories of my childhood when my mother she would listen to this radio. We had this old radio set at home, and she would listen to this special, you know, there was timing. I don't exactly remember the time, but that was maybe like 4 to 5 or something, and then she would switch the, you know, radio on, and then would be these old Kashmiri songs by Raj Begum, and you know, all these singers, Shamima Dev.
Yeah.
You know, I always used to, and my mother would sing along. I always used to sort of remember these poems, these songs, and. And I think it came through that, honestly. And then I read Agha Shahid Ali, and he has had a great influence on my work, whatever I've done. He's had a great influence on my work. And then like his work, when you read his poems, it stands true even now. Like, you know, it's like he's done some sort of prophecy when you look at his work. And then I got really interested in his work, and I read a lot of his work, and you know, I've watched so many interviews of him, his brother, Iqbal, his brother, and you know, all of them. So I was really interested in
right.
And the way he described Kashmir was something, in a way, you know, it was very similar to how I saw it.
Right.
And that's how I started. He influenced me into, you know, writing a little bit. No, I wouldn't call it poetry, but, you know, a little bit. But I
mean, you're very modest, but I think you write really well. And, you know, I first learned about your poetry because of your wedding. So I think the girl who did wedding photography and filming for me, she had talked about certain elements that she noticed at your wedding, and I had seen a few photographs that had surfaced around the time, you know. So the one thing that I remembered very distinctly is that you had your poem beautifully framed and placed on each plate at the dining setup. And I believe you also did sort of a voiceover for the wedding film or the trailer, from what I can remember, right? So talk to me about your insanely beautiful wedding. How did you guys manage to, first of all, do you see how I started with your poetry and now I'm going to your wedding? Because I'm so somehow forcefully trying to insert this question here. But how did you guys manage to pull something off like that in Kashmir? How was it received by your Kashmiri side of the family? It was so non-mainstream. Like, it was not, I don't know, it was just so beautiful.
Yeah, well, it wasn't easy, you know, doing something like that in Kashmir. Well, it wasn't, first of all, it wasn't my idea entirely. It was my wife.
Yeah.
And she was like, okay, how about, you know, you tell. So the photographer that we had for our wedding, he's a friend of mine.
Yeah.
And so she was like, I initially didn't even think of him to call him for our wedding, but my wife was like, you know, this guy, he's your friend, so why don't you ask him if he can come to the wedding and if he can, you know, take pictures. It's like, okay, I'll ask him. So I asked Joseph, and he was like, yeah, cool, you know, whenever you want, I'll be there.
Yeah.
So I told him for the wedding, he came, and And before he came, he was like, my wife is a wedding designer and she's really interested in designing your wedding. At that time, I was like, I don't know what a wedding designer means. You know how Kashmiri weddings are, right? We do everything ourselves.
Right.
So I was like, okay, well, yeah, sure. If we can afford it, why not? So then she came on board. So both of them came on board and they planned everything. And it took us 3 months between me, Devika, the wedding designer, and Apsha, my wife. So it took us 3 months. So basically to organize everything. And I was in Kashmir, Devika was in Bombay, Apsha was in Dubai. So we were all sort of, going back and forth. But I had to do most of the work because I was in Kashmir.
So those three months
were like crazy.
And Amir, I was in London admiring your wedding.
Thank you. But it was like basically my wife's idea. And then obviously when Devika came on board and they sort of talked through about all of this, and I had no idea what was happening. And, they were like, okay, go to this place and see if they have this flower. And I'm like, okay, I don't know where to find it, because in Kashmir it's really difficult. So then we got somebody local who is he was an event sort of planner. And then so when Devika came, so she would ask him, okay, I want these flowers in this much quantity. And the guy was like, oh, we can't have them here. We have to get them from Bangalore or something. Yeah, and it was surprising to even me. I'm like, no. And even Devika was like, no, we're not getting them from Bangalore. We'll get them from here, Kashmir. We're in Kashmir. Why do you want to get flowers from
outside,
somewhere else if you're in Kashmir? Yeah. And then she did the hard work in the last like 4 or 5 days before the wedding. And she went to all these, this horticulture department, and she went to this, those flowers, shikara.
God.
She went to the like fields and got those flowers and everything. And and that's how it all came together. And one thing we wanted to make sure, both my wife and I, we wanted to make sure that we have, that Kashmiri touch in it, because it wasn't going to be like typical Kashmiri wedding.
Exactly.
So then we had these placemats, and we had these like gift boxes for the guests, and which were all made of
paper mache.
Yeah, it was all made locally and sourced locally. So that was something
fancy.
Nice. Yeah.
Fancy is the word.
It was quite intimate, actually. We didn't have many guests. It was mostly like, so all her family flew in, and then my immediate family were there. And obviously, it was not a typically Kashmiri wedding. Then obviously my relatives were like, oh, well, yeah, you got married, but, it was not a
wedding.
Where
is the wedding?
you need to do another wedding. And then we ended up doing another Kashmiri wedding, especially for our Kashmiri. Especially for the, relatives in Kashmir.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that is, I'm not surprised. You talked a little bit about your wife, and I noticed that you get very excited when you talk about her. So question is, how does your wife compliment you on your work often, or is she your biggest critic?
She's both, actually.
Amir, I kind of feel like this sucks.
Yeah. Not once, many times.
And
that's what I really, admire about her, that she's very honest.
Mm.
And if there's something, I take a photo and I show it to her, she's like, oh, this is nice. And if she doesn't like it, she would say it on my face that, this sucks.
Wow.
This is not good. And I think that has, honestly, that has helped me quite a lot. And also with my writing. She's like this. She needs to have everything perfect. The comma needs to be here. There needs to be a full stop here.
It's not your, it's you apostrophe R-E.
exactly. He's so very like, you know, about especially writing.
Yeah.
Always like, no, you don't do this. You have to do it this way. And sometimes we argue about things. But yeah, she's been both. She's been, you know, she would compliment me. She says something nice, and if she doesn't, she would tell me on my face.
Awesome. No, that's amazing. I think that kind of helps because your wife is obviously looking out for you and she will never give you feedback that isn't valid. So huge shout out to her if she's listening. And so, all right. So Amir, back to photography. Having worked in this industry for so long now, I'm sure you've had to deal with all kinds of clients, right? Appreciative clients, difficult clients, miser clients. See what I did there? It's critical to have a logical framework for your services, which includes, you know, contracts, cancellation policies, pricing. How did you go about getting all of that in place? Because, you know, I mean, for me, for example, with my podcast, I was like, okay, when I share these questions with my guests, how am I doing it? What is the template? And you talked about having a media kit and everything. How did you, you know, how did you learn about drafting a contract or putting together policies or your pricing or a media kit?
Right. So initially, like when I started working, I used to do everything on my own. You know, I would obviously, because you know it was such a small thing, and I would basically not draft the contract, but the clients would draft the contract. I would just sign. You know,
okay.
I wouldn't even read it. It was like that. But over the time, I realized that okay, you know, contracts are for a reason, and you need to read them. And if you don't agree on certain points, you need to tell them and make changes and stuff like that. But it's not, you know, something you know when you start, but you have to know it. And I started learning from, you know, online research. I did a lot of online research, especially like this, even with this media kit or my portfolio. You just go on Google and just type that, you know, you portfolio examples or templates, and you'll get hundreds and thousands of results,
right.
And then you make one. So you sort of start there. And with the pricing is always tricky because, you know, at the end of the day, it's art. And, you know, it's initially I was reluctant or hesitant. I was like, okay, I don't know how much should I price it for. And then I would agree to what the client would say. But then, you know, like I said earlier, you need to know your worth, and you need to put your foot down and do it. And before, like, you know, now I have somebody who looks after these things and who basically manages all my contracts and clients. So he does all the contracts, cancellations, even pricing now. So I leave it all on him now. But obviously it came after a few years. It wasn't there initially, this guy. So
yeah.
I had to deal with it myself. But I think, you know, you learn, and it's all sort of a learning process when you start.
Correct.
You reach a level where you can basically negotiate with the client.
Right.
And then sort of, yeah,
and also
easy.
So I think I absolutely agree. I think sometimes as human beings, we tend to overcomplicate things, which is how do I do this and how do I do that? I think everyone literally lives off Google searches. And so the first thing is to just start, you know, YouTube and learn and read and all that stuff. And then the one thing I wanted to add to the pricing point is, you know, as a general rule, just don't say yes to the first thing that is thrown your way. Always know that the client will always give you the lower end of what they're willing to pay, and negotiate.
Sometimes they won't even pay you, you know.
Exactly.
They are not willing to pay it.
And don't fall for it, as Amir had mentioned. And the other thing is, as you work with more and more clients and you see how much people are willing to pay you, you will find a sweet spot. And, you know, you will eventually come up with a reasonable rate card or whatever.
And, you know, this reminds me of something. When I got my first, like, big contract, I remember there was, we were actually, I think, two or three of us who were sort of selected for that assignment. And one of my friends was in there too. And he had worked with the client before. So he phones me and he's like, oh, they've selected you as well. And I was like, that's great, you know. And then he was like, So what are you going to charge them? I said, you know, I gave him a certain, it's like maybe this. And he was like, are you crazy? I was like, what? Yeah. Is it too much? He's like, no, it's too little. You need to charge them more. And then he told me, yeah. And, you know, it's because, like, you know, luckily he was a friend and he told me that you should charge this much. So then I was like, are you sure I can charge them this much? What if they cancel it? And they say, no. You know, honestly, I was like a bit, you know.
Scared,
he was like,
yeah.
No, do it. Yeah. And then I did it and they paid me. So, you know, you have people, well, once you start working, you obviously network, you'll meet people and you'll make friends. So that also helps. And there will be people who will sort of guide you and help you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And as a photographer, do you think you've made any major blunders that have taught you important lessons?
I wouldn't say major blunders, but I have, I mean, obviously, if you talk about initially, my photographs were really bad when I look at them.
That, you know, I already disagree with that line, but okay, go on.
No, I'm like, why would I do that? But I think once I started working a little, you know, efficiently, more efficiently, a little better, I sort of realized that, you know, you have to have that, you know, you must know your worth, because brands, like you said, they will say, okay, we'll pay you this much. It would be way less than, you know, what you would be expecting.
Correct.
But if you know that your price is, say, this amount, and you won't go lower than that, then don't, you know. Maybe you can, maybe you, you know, lose a contract, but don't go lower, because it affects the market. Then for you, then, you know, everybody will be like, oh, well, you did this for, you know, this amount for this brand. Why can't you do the same for us? So you sort of set your own pricing in that sense, especially if you're a freelancer. Yeah.
Gotcha.
So I think that's what's important, to know your worth and don't go down.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah. And Amir, if you could turn time back, would you change anything about your journey or some of the decisions you took along the way? Any regrets?
I don't have any regrets. I mean, I'm here after all these experiences, and I think everything, you know, that you do in life, that you go through, it teaches you something. And all these things that I've learned over the time through my mistakes, or, you know, just through experiences, and it has led me to where I am today. And I wouldn't really change anything. I'm content with where I am right now.
That made me very happy. I hope your dad, I'm sure your, make your dad listen to this episode, okay? Like, make sure he listens to this.
you know, one day, like, it was in my first year only when I returned, and he was like, not first year, I think second year, when something, I think there was a TV interview or something, and he saw it. And then in the evening when he came home, he was like, I need to talk to you. He was sitting and he's like, but so explain to me, what do you do? So I telling him everything, and I'm showing him all these photos and all the work that I've done and everything. You know, it happened, I think, for a couple of hours. And then he's like, yeh sab toh theek hai, but tum actually kya karte?
What do you actually do? Yeah.
Yeah. So he's like, what do you actually do? This is fine. What do you actually do? So I don't know if he'd still, but he's been very supportive. I mean, I wouldn't say that, you know, he's not been supportive.
Okay, so if your dad is listening right now, hi. Amir is such a huge source of inspiration for so many people, not just in Kashmir, but outside. And we love his work. He's here for a reason. And I hope that you see why he's doing what he's doing. And also thank you for supporting him, is my message to your dad. So yeah, but 100%. And so Amir, this is one question which I sometimes bring up in our interviews, is which is, if you were not a photographer, what would you be?
I'd probably be a writer.
Okay. Yeah, that I see that. Probably should have guessed that. So what's happening in life right now and what does the future hold for you?
So what's happening in, right now, I'm in Paris and I am doing my master's in filmmaking. And this is my final semester. Actually, it's going to finish soon, hopefully in July, August this year. My dream has always been, you know, doing something for Kashmir and basically telling stories in Kashmir and off Kashmir. And that's why I'm doing this course. And I eventually want to go back after I finish and start making films in Kashmir. And basically, like I said, you know, we need to tell our stories ourselves and reclaim the narrative.
100%.
Yeah, that's the goal.
And every time you make something, I will tag along because I'm so curious to see your process.
Yeah, you should. I mean, you know, whenever you're in Kashmir, inshallah.
Yeah, for sure. And so, all right. I mean, we've reached the end of the episode, which is so crazy to me because time just, I don't even know where it went. But this last section, Amir, as you know, is called the, I'm embarrassed at this point. I'm calling it Spill the Sauce, which needs to change. I change it in every episode, so I'm not certain what this section is really called. But what advice do you have for aspiring artists, you know, especially photographers who are trying to make it in Kashmir, you know, who are trying to build their network, get clients, scale? What concrete steps can they take or what mistakes can they avoid to stay on track to success?
The first thing is focus on your portfolio and not just on Instagram or social media.
Yes.
Because that's what eventually will get you work, honestly. There's only so much you can do on Instagram or, but majority of the work lies out of Instagram. So make a portfolio, start building your portfolio, and also do not fall for numbers on social media. It's just there, you know, it shouldn't affect you anyway. So if you're true to your art, but first of all, you know, most importantly is know what you want to do, because for a long time I did not know what I wanted to do. And if you're 100% sure, then only invest in it, I would say, because that's when you would basically enjoy what you do. So know what you want to do and then focus on it and don't look back. People will always be, you know, that critical and stuff, and learn from the criticism. You know, you'll make mistakes and that's fine. That's totally fine. You won't make money initially. That's also fine. Like I said, 1 year I had no income. But you just carry on, and if you are passionate about it, you will make it. Honestly, I genuinely believe that.
Yep, and consistency is everything, which I am not consistent, so that sounds ironic, but I am I am trying, and no, I think those were all very actionable items, Amir, so thank you for sharing. And I just wanted to say that I am mind blown by your wisdom, your experience, so you know, thank you for sharing. I know, like, people don't really know that we have a very funny equation offline. So this feels weird saying it to you. But thank you for sharing, you know, your deep expertise and knowledge with our listeners. You know, your work is incredible. Your personality is incredible. Your mission statement and what you stand for is incredible. So I'm just so humbled by the fact that you decided to share your success story with us. And I'm confident... Yeah, and I'm confident that so many of our listeners will benefit from it. But above all, I'm grateful to have found a new friend in you. You already know this. And I was telling my partner the other day, I'm like, oh my God, I have a new friend who actually knows his way around Kashmir. And every time I'm there, I'm not going to spend any time with you. I'm just going to go to my friend and we're going to explore Kashmir. And no, he was really happy to hear that. So I'm hoping to do a lot more with you in the future. And I'm dying to meet your wife. So that's another one. And to all the Lavender Mavens who tuned in today, huge shout out to you guys. go rate the podcast and drop a review if you enjoyed this episode. And I will see you guys next week. Till then, chin up. Yeah.